had a great call-in radio show number 24. We had some great questions today about negative self-talk, kind of beating yourself up, and how do we sort of change the way that we think in order to change the way that we feel. We talked, had a great question about sort of how do we improve dating and having it not take away from, you know, our other priorities. And at the beginning of the conversation, I talked a little bit about cancel culture and why it's important to forgive people, why it's important to have self-worth, why it's important to consider other people worthy even when they mess up. And that's why we also had a question about, you know, how do we help someone with narcissism in a friend group and encouraging them to get therapy, and why we should promote redemption in our culture, because it's really important as a civilized culture to give people the chance to redeem themselves. Hey everyone, welcome to Maximus Live number 24, actually. I can't believe we've done so many episodes, but great to see growing audience and great to reconnect with all of you. And we're going to change it up the format a little bit today. I've noticed it takes us a little bit of time to warm up, so I'm going to do a little bit of a soliloquy at the beginning of each show, talk just about kind of weekly current events and my thoughts on them. And then we will take questions from the audience. We're streaming on every single platform possible now. I think we're on Discord, Instagram, TikTok, Twitter Spaces, and Clubhouse. So and YouTube Live. So feel free to submit your questions from any and all platforms there. Thanks for everyone who's joining us. So this week, I actually wanted to talk... this week's unpopular opinion is about cancel culture. And my unpopular opinion is that people who cancel others to never work again are the actual assholes, not the people that are being canceled. And I'll tell you why. I think firing by public petition is actually doubly dumb. First of all, it's really empowering the madness of crowds. And we know that, you know, when you whip up sort of the anger of a mob, people make completely irrational decisions, destroy public property, etc. And it's not smart to sort of cave into, you know, like public chaos and anger, which doesn't promote sort of rational decision-making. And the second part of it, there's also a lack and a cowardice of leadership when you allow sort of cancel culture to happen at your organization, because the leadership is usually afraid of obviously making the organization look bad, that people are going to, customers are going to quit, advertisers are going to pull out. And so they feel almost blackmailed in a way to cave in to sort of the public pressure. And obviously they don't want to look bad at like they're supporting a particular point of view or an organ as the organization themselves. So the reason I bring this up is because if you've been following sort of the tech news, Antonio Garcia Martinez, who is a former Facebook PM and the author of Chaos Monkeys, recently got a job at Apple and was fired summarily shortly thereafter, because a passage they wrote in a book years ago was sort of unearthed by some employees. They started a petition, a few thousand people signed it, and they promptly fired him. The irony of the whole situation, of course, though, was that his book was quite famous. I think he did like several interviews about it. It was on some bestseller lists. So it wasn't like Apple didn't know about the book. In fact, Antonio, after, you know, this whole scandal occurred, mentioned that Apple actually had done extensive reference checking with people that he had worked with to make sure that, you know, that's not his actual real life persona. He's an artist, he's a creative, he's a writer. And what he writes about is often in the form of sort of gonzo journalism, right? It's a creative exaggeration in order to obviously, you know, create art and write his books. And the reference checks came back overwhelmingly positive. So Apple knew about his books. They knew about, you know, that he writes sometimes edgy material. They hired him anyway, and they were fine with that until enough people basically complained and they sort of gave in to the woke mob and fired him. So, you know, my point of view in talking about this is not to support or defend Antonio or the people who sort of feel one way or the other. I have a little bit of a higher level view about why it's dangerous to sort of promote cancel culture, because cancel culture basically means that because of your beliefs, we are going to cancel you and basically make you unemployable for the rest of your life, which is a very drastic punishment. If you think about it, even criminals, right? When they go off to prison, you know, you decide a term that's appropriate for the crime. And the general agreement in society is that when someone has paid their dues, right, they've served out their sentence, they're allowed to be welcomed back into society with open arms. Particularly if it wasn't a violent crime and you're not a convicted felon, it wasn't a felony, any sort of misdemeanors are generally like forgiven, and it's not held against people. But the new sort of notion is that if you said something that may be considered racist, misogynistic, or something-ist, that you basically have no right to ever be employable, and thus will push you into financial ruin indefinitely for the rest of your life. You're essentially blacklisted from ever working in tech again. And I think it'd be very difficult at this point for Mr. Martinez, who, by the way, is a minority Cuban Jew, which is kind of ironic to accuse him of racism, to never work again. I think this is very dangerous because, in my opinion, as a psychologist, redemption is a requirement of a civilized culture. It's barbaric, in fact, to basically outcast people from the tribe and say you are unworthy and never are allowed to rejoin ever again. Now, there may be certain extreme situations where someone's obviously a serial killer or a child molester or some things like that that we absolutely should not condone. But if you're talking about someone who wrote a passage in a book, which, by the way, 99% of people who complain about him never even read the context of what he wrote about. But I think it's a very, very dangerous precedent to set. And I think I also always talk about very publicly as a psychologist that I'm adamantly opposed to public shaming. Public shaming is basically bullying with the veneer of morality. But the thing is, we as a society, even if there are improvements to be made, right? If for instance, Mr. Martinez like has to improve the way that he's talking about women, then the hope would be to have a dialogue with him, talk about why, you know, some of the things he says are hurtful and improve that so that this doesn't continue, right? But the thing is, when you bully people and cancel people, it doesn't change behavior at all. It actually just drives behavior underground because you don't allow for a chance for redemption. What Apple should have done is said, hey, look, you know, I'm getting complaints about our employees. We should have a public forum. We should discuss this, right? And ultimately, the leadership needs to make a decision and stand behind the decision to hire people. It's not like there was new information that essentially was not available at the time. Now, by the way, there is an important distinction between public and private shaming. I actually, contrarianly, do believe in private shaming. Private shaming is what your family and your friends do when you put on a little bit of weight and they're like, hey, man, you're a little like fatter in the cheeks there. Maybe you want to lose a little weight. But they can do that because they're your loved ones and they're not embarrassing you in public, right? You don't, like, a husband doesn't do that to their wife at a dinner party, right? He says that in the privacy of their bedroom or vice versa. And that's important because that obviously can help keep sort of behavior in line. But that's a very different thing than sort of public shaming, which obviously can lead to, depression, suicidal behavior, etc. So the moral of the story that I want to communicate is if psychology has taught me one thing, it's that forgiveness is the foundation of mental health. Canceling people from making a living is basically persecution on the basis of their beliefs. And even if you don't like their beliefs or you disagree with their beliefs, the reason that we have the First Amendment is to protect free speech. And in my opinion, canceling people on the basis of regular beliefs is basically a hate crime. And if we're trying to unite America, then we have to offer redemption to people. So I think this is really important because, you know, one of the things that we do in therapy as a psychologist is to really like bolster people's self-worth. I always tell people it's really important to believe that you are worthy as a human being. That means you're no less than anyone else. It also means that you're no better than anyone else either. And the danger of sort of the woke culture that we're seeing right now is that there comes with an air of moral superiority, right? That if you are woke, that you are socially progressive, if you understand sort of issues of race and sex, you are better than the ignorant people who don't know this, right? The problem is it reduces our empathy and our compassion for other people, right? Even people who are ignorant have worth. It's our job to educate those people, right? Not cancel them into financial oblivion, right? And we know this because one of the propaganda tools of war is when you're fighting an enemy, you don't consider them human. You consider them beneath human. And that's how you can morally justify killing people. And that's essentially what we're doing. We're socially killing people because they're saying these people are not worthy. They're not human beings. They're not worthy of redemption. And it's not to say that there isn't, to add a little bit of nuance, it's not to say that there isn't superior and inferior, right? Now, when it comes to abilities, right, and qualities, when you do a performance review, yes, you can say this person, this employee did a great job. It's above average. It's important to acknowledge differences, but we should promote competition in a healthy way. We should say, like, this is better, this is worse, this is good, and this is bad. But worth, underlying self-worth is basically unconditional, and it cannot be stolen from you. It cannot be shamed away from you. And to me, what makes a society civilized and what makes a society great is this concept of redemption. It's the very foundation of all the great moral traditions, essentially. And redemption requires believing that people have worth and are thus they're worth saving, essentially, right? So without redemption, essentially, you see society regress into cruelty and regress into savagery, and we lose everything that we have sort of built. So that's why you see psychologists like myself, you see Jordan Peterson fighting so hard against cancel culture. It's not that we don't care about issues about race or sex or trans or whatever the issue du jour is, but if you've studied history, you know that suppressing free speech and persecuting people for thought crimes is essentially what authoritarian regimes have done, and it literally has led to the genocide and murder of millions of people. It's a very fine line. It starts with canceling people, starts with blacklisting people, not allowing them to work, shunning them from society. It's not actually that many steps removed from removing them altogether from society. So on a very personal level too, I find it incredibly hurtful because I've worked with people who have been canceled. And, you know, it drives people literally to depression and suicide. I think it's a very dangerous thing because when you put a scarlet letter on people and say, you are the enemy, right? And you are unworthy as a human being, you can never be sort of redeemed. You're basically humiliating them and shunning them. And it creates sort of a social death sentence, which, you know, if we are as social creatures, is honestly like the worst form of punishment that you can do. So the cure for mistakes, in my opinion, is not canceling people. The first thing you should do is look, if you don't like someone's belief, just ignore it. If it's not worth your time. Now, if you're trying to protect someone from abuse, not in an abstract way, but someone literally is being abused or being harassed, obviously you should fight back. You should step in. You should say something about that. If it comes from ignorance, like if someone is saying something that's offensive and they don't, you know, fully understand what they're saying or don't understand the impact of their words, then it's our job to educate those people. That's why you should have a dialogue with someone who's saying something that may be hurtful. And if you know that it's their obnoxiousness is coming from a place of hurt, right? It's a projection that's happening. That's when compassion is really helpful, right? You see this with narcissistic people, right? Narcissistic people are inherently insecure on the inside. And if you know that, you can have a little bit more compassion with them. Doesn't mean you need to tolerate obnoxious behavior, but you know that they're sort of hurting on the inside. But I think it's really, really important to basically offer redemption to people that even when they have done wrong, right, you give them a chance to redeem themselves and rejoin society, because that's the way that we heal as a people. So regardless of what your stance is on this particular, you know, issue, I think it's important that when people have done wrong, that we give people a chance to redeem themselves, to rejoin society, because that's the only way we're going to address racism, sexism, you know, all the other issues that we're facing today. And that's why I take a very strong stance against cancel culture. And I think the way that we're approaching it is just terribly wrong, and it's terrible for society. So I very much encourage all of our listeners to speak out against it, quite frankly. And it's unfortunate that in the tech industry, we haven't seen that happen. I only saw three investors, and there may be more, that publicly spoke out about it. Mick Solana at Founders Fund, Gary Tan at Initialized Capital, and Paul Graham of Y Combinator. Those are the only three people besides myself in tech that I saw speak out against the cancel culture that was happening in this particular incident. Maybe there's more, but I think a lot of people, even though they agreed with it, they DM me privately saying they support my point of view. Publicly, they're afraid to speak out because they're like, oh, I'm going to get canceled too if I, you know, support this. And they're going to brand me with a racist or sexist sort of label. And that's how they win. So I think it's very important for people who are listening. If you also, you know, believe in it, you got to speak out. And if you don't, they're going to go after you next. So that's, I think it's your moral imperative. It's our moral imperative, to be able to, speak out against wrong, And I don't think there's any greater wrong than essentially what we're doing to people. The irony, by the way, of cancel culture is, you know, we're obviously trying, you know, the people who are promoting it are trying to promote an enlightened behavior. But the irony in doing so is that they're being savages about canceling people and not giving them any chance of redemption. So that's the irony about the whole thing. It's not a very enlightened or progressive view at all. It's literally what we did back in the day when you threw people out of a village, or you tarred and feathered people and shamed them in a public square. I think, in fact, it's a very regressive behavior to things that we saw hundreds of years ago when we stopped publicly shaming people. We stopped publicly hanging people in front of everyone else because it was humiliating and quite frankly, cruel and barbaric. And so when we see that kind of behavior, I think we have to speak out against it. Because it's definitely a wrong.
With friends and stuff like that, people who have narcissistic personality disorder.
Mm-hmm.
I just actually had a conversation with my group of friends. One of my friends, he's kind of has that. And he's been like, you know, treating our friend group not so, like, you know, having his own interest over friends.
Right.
And we had a conversation yesterday, and it went really well. Mm-hmm. And we kind of practice that compassion, but also kind of highlight examples. Right. So that went really well because he kind of saw the trend and he wasn't seeing it.
Yep.
So my question is, how do you kind of move forward? Because I know that changing habits or creating new habits is extremely hard, and getting rid of old ones is really challenging. Right. So how do you help your friend who kind of has kind of the same reoccurring problem, where you can help him guide to a better path where he thinks about others instead of himself?
Yeah, first of all, it's a great question about, you know, how do you work with someone who's on the narcissistic spectrum, if you will? I don't know if he's been formally diagnosed with narcissistic personality disorder, who, you know, maybe acting in a way that's not as conducive to friendship or a friend group. And I admire, by the way, that you took him aside and gave him feedback. I will tell you, 80-90% of people will not bother. They just drop people like that, right? I think you're doing a great job of practicing what we preach in terms of redemption. Now, here's the thing. Like I said, you don't need to tolerate abuse, right? There is a fine line. And the thing is, look, redemption also means that you have to pay your dues, right? When someone does something wrong, it doesn't mean that you immediately, you know, walk them back into the fold. That's a reason people, you know, have to do hundreds of hours of community service or weeks or months of years of jail time because they need time to rehabilitate themselves or go to therapy. So the first thing that I would do is I think you're doing the right thing and just saying, hey, look, this is what, you know, is we're, you know, not tolerable, right? This is not acceptable behavior in terms of our friend group. Now, I know you may be sort of imperfect about it, but if you're willing, I'm going to give you feedback you know, when it's happening. Now, the thing is, like I said, I don't believe in public shaming. So unless it's like, you know, if someone's doing something and you want them to stop in the moment because they're, let's say, I don't know, being cruel to someone in your friend group, you should call that out in the moment, right? So that the behavior doesn't perpetuate or continue. That I think is fair because you're stopping something from happening in real time. Now, if someone makes a snide comment, they move on from it, but you can tell that that person was kind of hurt because, I don't know, they were like negging them or insulting them in sort of way. That may be helpful to pull that person aside, you know, immediately after you're hanging out in a group and say, hey, buddy, bro, I don't know if you realize this, but when you said that comment, I could tell that she was hurt by it or he was hurt by it. And I just wanted to communicate that with you because I know that we've talked about this earlier and we agree that when you do these things, you know, I'm going to give you feedback so that, you know, I'm not sure you're always aware of it, but that you can grow and develop. So I think that's an example of like where it may be helpful to do that publicly, where it may be helpful to do that privately. And, you know, even though you're right, it is very hard to change behavior. The good news is we are exquisitely social creatures. And so, you know, pulling someone aside, even who's narcissistic, and you give them that sort of feedback, it is very humbling, even for a narcissist, to hear that if they're not so extreme and so pathological, they're not willing to hear it and they're in denial, right? So I guess my question to you is, when you pulled him aside and you had that conversation, what was his reaction? Was he rejecting of it? Was he accepting of it?
He was super accepting. And the reason why is because the behavior has been happening. So we're like childhood friends. Yeah. We've grown up like 5 years old. We're 23 now, kind of entering the workforce. We played sports together. So we have like this bond and friendship between like eight guys. Like it's like, you know, one of the strongest bonds. And we want to keep it that way. But the thing is, he kind of like burned bridges. He's been doing this for a while.
Right.
But the thing is, like, you know, you see it like, oh, they're you know, young or they're a kid. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
But the thing is, it kind of gets to the point where, you know, the last few times, like, it's kind of big events where you're like, okay, we can't handle this anymore. So the thing is, he kind of had no choice but to kind of listen and hear us out. And he did a good job. And I think that over the conversation, it was just like one example and then another example. And then it started to become more clear where it's just not like it's a one-off thing.
Right.
It's like a pattern. And that's what I think he kind of – it clicked for him. I'm just hoping that he'll actually follow through.
Yeah. I hope so too. But, I mean, the good news is, at least from the way that you're describing it, he's unlikely to be what's called a malignant narcissist that's almost – you know, not likely to change, right? The telltale sign of like a narcissist is when you sort of like talk to them about it. By the way, most narcissists know they're narcissists. In fact, there's research that was done that I think there's like a 20 item narcissism personality test that you can take. And then they compared it to just this one item test, which was basically, are you a narcissist? And it correlates pretty well. Most narcissists are well aware of the fact that they are because they've probably gotten enough feedback over time. Now, they may not realize the extent to which they are or how often they are or some of the things that they are doing that may seem narcissistic, but they're generally kind of aware. That's what I would say. The malignant narcissists, though, they're either not aware or if they are, their ego defenses are so strong, they're so fragile that if you gave them that sort of feedback, they'd be like, oh no, what are you talking about? You guys are just a bunch of pussies. You know what I mean? They would regress into that kind of defensive shell and not be able to hear you. It doesn't sound like he's doing that, which tells me that, okay, he is sort of redeemable. Now, there's probably a lot of work for him to do and a lot of support that he needs from you if you decide that your friend group is willing to essentially like trudge through the journey with him. I would privately actually very much encourage him to go into therapy. The thing is, narcissists very rarely go into therapy for the treatment of narcissism. They often go to therapy for two reasons. One, it's because their wife, their boss, or their friend group, as in your case, basically has told them their behavior is problematic and they need help, right? So they kind of go begrudgingly. Or two, they're going for other reasons. Maybe they have depression or anxiety because obviously the way that they're handling social situations is not good. They don't really have deep quality interpersonal relationships, but they don't realize that it's them that's causing it, right? And so sometimes they'll just go to therapy to have an audience and they like talking to someone who will listen to them without running away. So they're very, very hard to treat. However, when you sort of get someone who's like, okay, there's a superordinate value for me to go to therapy, which is I've been childhood friends with this friend group of eight guys, and I want to stay friends with them. And for me to do so means, I got to go to therapy and like get my act together and work on my shit. Then that may be a compelling enough reason for him to decide to do that. And I hope it is. So that's the first thing that I would do is like, look, it's not going to be all on your shoulders. You can't cure this man of narcissism, but I think you can encourage him to get professional help to do that. It's going to take time, probably a more psychodynamically oriented therapy. The evidence base has shown to be particularly helpful with personality disorders, and it's going to take a while. But what I would think in terms of your role and your friend group's role is to be sort of the adjunctive support to that therapy, right? He needs to do his own work. He is responsible for his own redemption, right? In the end, like, you know, the person has to make the effort, right? The only person that can change you is you. So if he decides that it's worth it to change his behavior because your relationships are meaningful enough and also his future relationships, like if he really wants to be a functional person, I doubt if he's doing this with you guys who have known and been close to him, he's 100% doing with other people, and they're not going to tolerate his bullshit as much as you guys are, right? So if he does this with someone he's dating, you know, it's going to be a much thinner ice that he's walking on than you guys, which are or who have been obviously much more forgiving. But what I think your role is to basically know that it's almost like if you had a friend who had an alcohol problem, you'd have a group intervention with him. You'd be like, look, you got to go into rehab. We're going to support you, sign you up for whatever it is. Smart Recovery is the one that I recommend as an alternative to AA. And then, you know, as we go out or we hang out, I'm sure we'll see you slip. And as we do so, we'll support you. We'll obviously encourage you. If we see that you're, you know, acting out, we'll, you know, try to get you back on the straight and narrow. So, you know, I think your role is to just almost like reinforce the lessons that he's getting from therapy. And when he continues to sort of act in a way that you see that's harmful, is basically give him feedback, right? Constantly be giving him feedback about what he's doing, because whatever, like I said, he's doing in a friend group, I'm sure he's doing with other people. And so you're almost creating, if you will, a safe space for him, which is exactly essentially what therapy is. Therapy is a safe container for people to talk about their issues, to get honest and constructive feedback without breaking the relationship, without running away, which is what most narcissists do, is they push people away. Right? So you're almost creating a group version of it. It's almost a group therapy, if you will. You're not obviously doing therapy on him, but you're trying to hold the container for him and say, look, we eight guys are going to try to hold this container for you and give you a chance over the next days, weeks, months, maybe longer, for you to gradually improve. We know that some days are going to be better. Some days are going to be worse in terms of you slipping up. Obviously, if he gets sort of stressed or depressed or other things, he may slip back into some of the behavior, as most people do when they experience difficult times. But your job is to constantly give him that feedback and be like, all right, this is not acceptable. This is acceptable. Hey, you've been slipping up again, but we're here for you. We support you. We want to make this work. And that's basically, you know, I think the best that you guys can do.
Definitely. Thank you so much. He's done it not just to our friends, but to a lot of people.
For sure.
And he's very charismatic. He's high energy. That's why people love him. So I think that, you know, recommending a therapy or behavioral psychologist, that's what I recommended my friends. But it's hard to have that conversation with someone like that.
Totally.
So I'm trying to figure out a good way to kind of deliver the message. I think yesterday went really well. So I have more confidence in delivering that message and hopefully receiving it. It's just like one thing from like, you know, recommending it. There's another thing like, you know, actually taking action and going and doing it and setting up time and actually, you know, working on it. And that's where I think with the, like you said, the friend group, that's where you can work on it. But I think that having someone outside the friend group where you can kind of bounce, you know, really like walk through the behaviors, I think that would be great.
Yeah. And by the way, having like telling people, it's always a hard conversation to tell people, oh, you really need therapy. I mean, one way that I sort of handle that is I destigmatize it. Need, I hate the word need, because need basically means like, oh, I got a broken leg, I need to go to the ER, right? Versus therapy should not be framed as a need. Therapy should be framed as something that everyone can benefit from, just some people can benefit more. That's the way that I would put it. Like everyone, literally everyone. I mean, you don't even have to have a DSM diagnosable mental health condition to have therapy. I talk about this often in my practice. 80% of my clients do not have a mental health disorder. They're CEOs who just want to be better. They want to run their companies more effectively with less stress. And I think that really destigmatizes, because do they need to be working with me? Absolutely not. But does an athlete need a coach to be better? No, they could do it on their own. LeBron James at this point knows probably everything there is to know about basketball, but he still benefits from a coach, a personal trainer, a masseuse, a sports psychologist, because he wants to be at the top of his game. And I hope your friend does too. So I would pull him aside personally. Those are better conversations to have one-on-one. Say, hey, look, I really appreciated. Start out with a compliment. Say, I really appreciated your willingness to listen to me when I brought this up last time. You know, I know it's really hard to like swallow, you know, feedback when, you know, you're obviously a great guy. You're very, as you said, charismatic, you know, et cetera. And so I know it's hard to hear these things, so I appreciate it. I just wanted to follow up though, you know, because I was thinking about how can I help you be the best man that you can be, you know, and I consulted some of my, you know, friends and colleagues. And one of the things that came up is, you know, is that therapy would be very, very helpful, especially with dealing with some of this stuff that may be a little bit more, you know, deeply seated, personality oriented. I recommend finding a good therapist that, you know, probably psychodynamic and orientation has dealt with a lot of personality kind of stuff before. And what would it, you know, how does that sound to you? And, you know, and I want to make sure that, you know, if you did that, you have our support, in pursuing that. And, you know, we want to basically be your backup, as you go and pursue that. So that's the way that I would frame it, with them. And by the way, that's a great example of like the whole, the theme of redemption. If someone's not willing to like go to therapy, not, or at least do the work in one form or another, whether it's, you know, doing it on their own, doing it in therapy or some combination thereof, obviously that influences your decision as a friend group to accept that person and continue a relationship with them. But if someone's really willing to make the effort, they're willing to do the work, that's to me helps justify why you provide redemption to people. When people are, and you think about this, right? Like when people are in jail and they're up for parole, what does the parole board do? They're like, has this person been behaving well? Have they not gotten in trouble in jail? Have they been productive during their time? They've gotten their continuing education. Do they seem like they're rehabilitating themselves in order to become a redemptive member of society? And then they review all that behavior and they make a decision. Yeah, we're going to let this person out early or we're not. Right. And so it's the same thing, I think, with our relationships, too, in terms of whether we tolerate bad behavior or not is I think there's a difference between someone who's genuinely trying, putting in the time, effort and money to go to therapy in order to make it work versus someone who's like, nah, it's not really worth it to me. And I think that's where you can sort of make the determination about, you know, where your willingness, quite frankly, is to hold on to relationships. Lies.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Dr. Cam. You've been extremely helpful, just like, you know, with the scenario and also like just hearing your talks every week. I kind of use that, you know, use the culmination of all the knowledge, you know, going into the situation. So that was super helpful. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. And one last thought about it is, you know, it's really hard to exclude someone from a group because, like I said, it's almost like an ostracizing kind of thing. I think when you frame it as it's really the ball's in their court, right? I know it's a little bit of an ultimatum to say, go to therapy or you can't be our friend. I don't think you should obviously present it like that, but I think you have to say, hey, look, you know, your behavior is having a negative impact on some members of our group. We've been childhood friends for a long time. We want to continue to be friends for a long time. But things have to change and it's up to you to do it. And we're going to help support you through it. But we think the best way, and the evidence shows the best way, is probably you need to go work on this in a concrete way. And there's good evidence that working with a psychologist is the best way. And that really gives us, you know, faith that you're trying to make things work. And if you're willing to make it work, we're willing to make it work. So really the ball's in your court, right? So you're not kicking him out of your friend group. It's up to him. If he decides that he doesn't want to do the work, then he's choosing to leave the friend group on his own. And that way, when you kind of give people their choice, their agency, then they're like, okay, maybe it's not worth it for me to go through all this, right? The pain and the effort to go through this. But then it was their choice. It wasn't like, oh, these guys screwed me over and they kicked me out. And I think that's the broader lesson for all things of redemption is, look, as I said, you can't change anyone. You can only give people the knowledge, tools, and skills for them to change themselves. But when you give people choices and say, hey, look, these are the requirements. This is what I expect in a relationship. This is what, you know, acceptable behavior is in a group, in an organization, in a company, right? We should all have standards and people should be willing to uphold them. But I think it is reasonable to say, look, it's your responsibility, but we give you the guidance and the support to help push you along the way. And if you're not willing to do it, then that's on you to leave this friend group, to leave this organization, to leave society, right? But then we're not kicking them out. We're not canceling them. They're choosing to extract themselves. And in that way, there isn't like, you know, an anger about it because they know that it was their choice. They could have chosen differently. And I think that's how you reduce kind of issues of like, you know, mass violence and other things when people feel very excluded, persecuted, and then they, you know, want to obviously, you know, fight back in sort of some weird way.
Definitely. I'm all about redemption, and it shows their true character when they put in the work and they are conscious about, you know, their behaviors and stuff like that. That honestly builds, I told my friend, that builds trust, and right. I want to have trust with you. So thank you very much. I really appreciate the advice.
My pleasure. Yeah, follow up in a few future weeks. I'd love to hear sort of how it progresses. It's obviously going to be slow and steady, but if you have an update in a few weeks or a few months, love to hear it.
Is there a name for feeling like a complete failure when you have just the slightest misstep, even after having a streak of several small wins, mm-hmm. shall we call them, in a row?
Sure.
I've been guilty of that, and the feeling fortunately lasts me only like a few minutes where I feel like garbage, mm-hmm. and then I realize it wasn't so bad. But I'm left feeling really sour that, well, I felt like that.
Right.
I just wanted to know if there's a name for it and what steps could be taken to mitigate that.
Yeah, well, great question. So the question is, you know, what's going on? It sounds like, if I'm interpreting your question correctly, what's going on when you know, you're doing well, you're having a small wins, and all of a sudden you trip up and you have a misstep and you feel like a total failure.
Yes.
Well, first of all, I'm sorry you feel that way. That sounds like a very rough way of living life, because, you know, if you've had a streak of wins, and of course you're not going to win every single little game or battle in life. And if you get sort of tripped up and you feel like a total failure or loser, you're going to experience a lot of hurt and heartbreak, along the way. So I guess my question to you is, can you give me an example, a concrete example of a time that maybe this happened recently, so I have a little bit of context?
Just this week,
mm-hmm.
it happened in the gym. I had been working towards a new PR,
yep.
and I totally missed it and I felt terrible.
Yeah. And then, did you have some small wins before that?
More precisely, after that, I hit all my numbers for all the other exercises,
okay.
but missed it on the first one of the day.
Yep. Okay.
That's why I felt like, okay, wasn't so bad.
But okay. So
the disappointment lasted me like 5 minutes.
So let's break that down. You had a goal for the day. You wanted to hit a PR in a certain exercise at the gym. You failed to do it. What was the thought that was going through your head the moment that you failed to do it?
If I'm being completely honest, mm-hmm. self-doubt.
So you had self-doubt, but what was the thought? Could you put it into a phrase? Like, what were you saying to yourself? You said self-doubt.
I felt like I have been preparing for this for weeks. Mm-hmm. I had done really well for several weeks in a row.
Right.
And now I missed the mark this time. Uh-huh. All of that was for nothing. I'm never going to be able to reach my goals.
Okay. And what does it say about you as a person?
I tend to lack confidence in my own abilities.
Right. That's after you calm down. But in that five minutes of time where you're beating yourself up, you're like, I'm never going to be able to do this.
How can I say it? That I had low worth?
Yeah, exactly.
As a person?
Right. Bingo. You hit the nail on the head, right? That you're a failure, right?
Right.
So this is really important. And then, okay, when you have this thought, I'm never going to be able to do this, I'm not worthwhile, I'm a failure, how did that make you feel emotionally?
Terrible.
Of course. Yeah.
Those 5 minutes were terrible.
Right. And when you say terrible, can you make it even more concrete? Because terrible is not an emotion. That's the extent of an emotion.
Well, I failed at this. I'm going to fail at most everything else I try afterwards.
Exactly. But how did that make you feel emotionally?
Really I was upset with myself. I was feeling very disappointed, sad, angry.
There you go. I love it.
Mostly angry.
There you go. So you're sad, you're angry. And so you see the connection now between your thoughts and your feelings. So in psychology, we always say feelings do not come out of nowhere. There's three things that happen in the sequence. There was a trigger or a situation in which you failed to hit a PR. And then there was an interpretation that happened, right? Okay, I didn't hit the number. I didn't hit the goal. And then you thought, okay, I didn't do it. But it was more than the fact that you didn't do it. You said, I didn't do it. I'm never going to be able to do it. I'm never going to be able to succeed at anything, and that I don't have worth. I am a failure, right?
Yes.
So, and then as a result of that, when that's a very, we hit what's called the hot thought there, right? If you just have the thought, I did not hit my PR of whatever, 200 pounds, that's not a really hot thought. But I don't have worth, I'm a failure, I'm never going to succeed at anything, that's a hot thought, right? When you even say it out loud, it hurts. It hurts for me to hear it, to be honest with you, right? And no wonder you feel sad, angry, dejected, you know, that you're never gonna do that, right? So let me ask you there, what is driving this? Is it the fact that you didn't hit your PR, or it's what you're telling yourself?
What was driving the feelings?
Yeah, why is this situation so difficult?
Originally, it was the fact that I missed the number. And I was really upset.
Right. But this is my point. Is it really about missing the number, or what it means to miss the number?
No, what it means.
Exactly. Right? So that's my point.
I'm never going to be able to reach my goals.
Missing a PR does not lead to everyone feeling sad, angry, and dejected. It does in your case, because you're interpreting it in a way that is very harsh. You're very harsh on yourself, right? And it's yes. By the way, the thoughts that you were able to clarify are textbook patterns of depressive thinking. So literally, when you study sort of depressive thinking in psychology, they've studied what are the thinking patterns of people who tend to have depression versus people who do not. And you know what the difference is? It's three things. People who are who have a tendency to experience depression think in a way that is global, personal, and stable. What does that mean? And we'll use your example. Global means, okay, I failed at this one PR. I'll never be able to hit any of my PRs, right? So you take one thing, one specific thing. And you, by the way, you said you were able to hit your PRs for the other things. But you extrapolate from that one failure, that one negative, and say, I'm not good at anything, right? Second thing, personal, mm-hmm. right?
Yes.
So why did you not hit your PR? What's an interpretation of why you did not hit that particular PR on that particular day?
After I calmed down, I thought, right, I wasn't rested enough. I hadn't prepared enough. I didn't warm up well.
Exactly. There's alternative explanations, right? Exactly. You didn't rest enough, hydration. You know, people's energy just varies on a day-to-day basis based on how they slept. A million other reasons. So, but instead of doing that, instead of making those external attributions, you're making an internal attribution. You're saying it's personal. I'm weak. I'm a failure. I'm a loser, etc. You're blaming. I don't have worth is the words literally that you said, or I was interpreting as saying, like, basically, I'm a failure, right? And then the last thing is they make a stable attribution. Stable attribution is as opposed to saying, I was not strong today. That's okay. Maybe my hydration was off. Maybe I was just not strong today. I'll do a good job, I don't know, tomorrow, next week. But a stable attribution for a person who's sort of depressogenic, if you will, is exactly the words that you use, that I'm never going to be able to do this, right? So that... Think about this. If you're thinking in this pattern, which is global, personal, and stable, it's my fault. I suck at everything, and it's always going to be this way. Of course, you're gonna basically be depressed. Versus, let's flip the inverse of all three of those statements, right? So, as opposed to being global, you're like, maybe I'm not good at this particular lift. And I'm good at a lot of other things. Maybe I'm not really good at weightlifting, but I'm good at many other hobbies and activities. That's okay too. Doesn't mean that you're bad at everything. Too personal. As you said, there's many other factors that could have contributed to the fact that I didn't hit this PR. It's not because I suck or don't have worth or don't have any potential as a weightlifter or athlete or any of these other things. There's other factors. Let me go figure out what those factors are, and let me go try again later. And then lastly, you don't make a stable attribution. You're like, this is temporary. I didn't achieve this goal today in this particular lift. That's okay. I'm confident that if I tweak things, I can do it another time, right? If you thought in the way that I just described, how do you think that would have made you feel? I missed this PR, probably due to some external factors like my rest and hydration and other things. It's not because I do not have worth. I'm good at other lifts. It's just this one lift that, I don't know, for whatever reason, maybe I didn't train it properly. And I'm confident that if I tweak these things, I'll be able to eventually do this in the future. If you tell yourself that now, how does that make you feel?
Better. And it's actually what I began thinking to myself after I had begun to calm down. I kind of used the anger that I felt during those brief minutes as a sort of motivation. And I did manage to beat all of the rest of my numbers afterwards.
There you go.
Pretty good after that.
Well, for sure. I mean, I'm glad you're channeling your angst in a positive way. And I think that it may be helpful for you to practice changing the way you think. The exercise that I just walk you through is just an example of cognitive restructuring, right? Cognitive restructuring is a fundamental sort of technique from cognitive therapy or what's called cognitive behavioral therapy. And basically, look, if you change the way you think, you'll change the way that you feel. And I think the way that you're thinking is not very effective, right? You're very harsh on yourself and you're making these negative, personal, global, stable attributions that are obviously going to make you feel bad. The good news, though, is that you're doing that to yourself. And that means if you're doing that to yourself, you can undo it, right? So this is in your control. I'm kind of giving you the power and saying, hey, look, it's not because of the PR at all. It's because of the way that you're interpreting it and the way that you're beating yourself up as a result of this. But that means if you know that, now this may be a little bit automatic, right? It doesn't seem like it's in your control because you have what are called ANTs, automatic negative thoughts. This is the way that you've been doing this because you probably have sort of a belief system that underlies all this that is a little bit, like I said, it's harsh on yourself, right? So if you have a core belief, right? And your core belief, by the way, is probably that you're not worthy. Right? And that is just lingering there underneath the surface all this time. And you probably don't even, you're not aware of it. It's kind of in the back of your mind. But once something happens that may confirm that core belief, like you missed that PR, boom, that incident triggers a thought, which triggers a feeling, which activates that core belief. And now you feel terrible about yourself, right? So, and that's probably what's happening over and over again. And you, no matter how many little successive wins that you have, you know, you get sort of defeated because you sort of beat yourself up unnecessarily. So what I would suggest is there's two things you can do. Is one, you can kind of change the way you think, just as we did in this exercise. You got to restructure your thoughts to not be more positive. The goal is not to be positive thinking, Pollyannish, optimistic, and say, I'm going to hit a PR every single time, no matter what. Or I'm worthy no matter what I do. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about realistic thinking. And realistic thinking is not beating yourself up. I'm never going to be able to do this. I suck at everything and it's my fault. Realistic thinking is, I missed today. Maybe there are some other factors. I can change them and I'll be able to do it. And look, even if I can't, I'm good at other things and I have self-worth, right? That is a more realistic, balanced way of thinking. And when you think that way, you're going to feel better. If you're not able to change that in terms of your restructuring, then I think diffusion, which comes from ACT, which is a kind of a complementary form of therapy to CBT, is just saying, hey, look, I'm noticing that whenever I have a failure, whenever I mess up at something, there's a part of me, that my mind, that beats me up, right? You can call it sort of your critical self. You can think about it as like the gym bully or the gym bro. It's like the 6'6" guy who's just like mean and narcissistic. And he's like, oh man, you missed that PR, dude. Like, why do you suck so much? Now, let me ask you a question. If there was a dude at your gym that did that to you, like he was watching your bench press and you watched you miss and he sat there and made fun of you, what would you think or how would you respond to that situation?
My lips are none of your business, or I'd appreciate some advice instead of criticizing me.
Exactly. So that's a great point, right? So if it was an external person, if it was a third party who's being that harsh with you, maybe you'd ignore him. Maybe you'd talk back to him, or maybe you'd be like, hey man, like instead of like beating me up, like give me some tips. Right. But I think all of that just illustrates that, you know, it's interesting that we wouldn't take that much shit from a third party, but why are you doing that to yourself? right? You are kind of letting that person kind of beat you up, because I think you're identifying with those thoughts, right? You're saying, those thoughts are me. Those thoughts are the truth. I'm going to take them literally, right? What I'm introducing is, okay, instead of doing that, instead of being like, oh, I'm a failure, I don't have worth, just be like, no, imagine this is a third party. This is not you. It's just your mind. As I like to say, you are not your mind. Your mind is not your friend, right? Your mind does not always say the most helpful, positive, constructive things. So if your mind is being a bully at the gym and or whenever you slip up and it activates that core belief of feeling unworthy, just thank your mind for that thought and be like, hey, man, I see what you're doing. I've heard that voice before. It's not really helpful for me in this moment. So I appreciate it. I know you want me to be better, but I don't need to listen to you, right? I don't need to take your shit. So thank you. I appreciate it. I know you want me to be better, but here's how I'm going to be better. I'm going to try to PR on the rest of my lifts today. And if I can't, I'm going to, you know, go back to the drawing board and figure out how I can, right? You don't need to listen to it. You don't need to listen to a bully. So why let that part of you, why let that part of your mind bully you?
Maybe because maybe it's a feeling of if I'm being harsh on myself, then other people's words won't have that much effect on me because I've already told myself the worst.
That's a very harsh way of living, I would say. I don't think you need to protect yourself from other people by beating yourself up even more. You know what I mean? You're basically saying, like, before someone else beats me up, I'm going to beat myself up to a bloody pulp. You know,
sounds terrible. What you say like that?
I don't think. Yeah, exactly. But I'm reflecting. I'm your mirror right now. I'm reflecting back and saying, well, it kind of sounds rational at first, but when you say it out loud, nah, not really. Right. You know what I mean? I don't think you need to be your own harshest critic. And this kind of alludes, by the way, to the whole redemption thing. Right. Remember what I said at the beginning of this conversation? I said it's really, really important to believe that you're worthy. And I want you to hear it from me. And I hope if there's one thing that you take away from this conversation, is that you're worthy. I don't care how much you lift at the gym. Now I do want you to get stronger, psychologically, physically, and you should too, right? But the thing is, you have to separate that from your self-worth, right? You need to develop a foundation, a core of worth, and say, no matter what happens, I am a person of worth. I am a man who is worthy. And at the same time, I'm gonna hold a dialectic that I can improve. Right? But I'm not improving my worth. I'm just improving my strength, my intelligence, my competence. These are just skills, right? But your skills do not determine your worth. Like, honestly, in the end, does your worth as a man or a human being depend on how much you bench press? No, of course not. That's not how I judge you. That's not how your wife judges you. That's not how your boss judges you. That's not how a friend judges you. That's not how your family judges you. They don't care how much you bench press. They care about, like, are you nice and treat them well? You know what I mean? Now, you should at the same time care about how much you bench press, because you need to have a goal and you need to have something to shoot for. And it's nice to have benchmarks and it's nice to feel competition and to strive for things and have a little challenge in your life, right? But that does not determine your self-worth. So you got to separate these things. And in my opinion, when you have a bulletproof self-worth and saying, look, none of this stuff is going to make me feel less than. This is the part where you need to talk back a little bit to that bully in your mind and say, hey, look, you're beating me up, but, you know, regardless of how you feel, I your worth is safe with me, right? This is where you step in as the leader, right? You are the leader of yourself. And even though you have parts of you that are very harsh or very critical and may have learned this negative pattern of behavior, you're going to step in and say, look, no matter what happens, if I hit this PR or not, or whatever happens, my self-worth is safe with me. It's bulletproof. It's untouchable. It's okay. Then you have a foundation to go try to achieve great things, strive for great PRs, do great things in your life, because you know that you're safe. You have a psychological safety net that you've established for yourself. So that's the beautiful irony of this. The whole thing that I'm describing is the way that you're running your life is like, okay, I'm going to just clobber myself to death every time I fail. You're not going to be able to get far, because what's going to happen? You take 4 steps forward and then you take 2 steps back every single time that you fail, right? And so you're operating at 50% efficiency. When you're bulletproof, when you're like, look, nothing that happens is going to let me not knock down or negate my self-worth, even when I fail, I'll be like, great, I failed. A learning experience, a learning opportunity. What can I learn from this, right? What can I do to be better? And if you frame it in that way, then you can still strive for PRs. You can still strive to be better at the gym. I'm not saying give up on your goals. I'm just saying don't let the success or the failure of your goals determine your self-worth as a human being. That is untouchable. It should always be.
Right. Thank you very much, Doctor. You gave me a lot to think about. I'll think about it. I'll sleep on it. And I'll make sure to post any progress on the Discord for accountability as well.
Absolutely. But please do.
Very helpful.
I hope so. And put it into practice on a regular basis. That's the most important thing. I'm glad that you brought up a concrete situation. There's going to be more, obviously, that happens outside of the gym, in real life. But remember the two core lessons that I said is the way that you think determines the way that you feel. And so if you change the way you think, you'll improve the way that you feel. So watch out for your negative, personal, global, stable patterns of thinking and try to think in a way that's more balanced and more effective. And what I mean by effective is it's going to let you not take two steps backwards every time that you time that you mess up. And if you're not able to change the way you're thinking, like I said, diffuse from your thinking. Realize that it's a part of you. It's just like a bully at the gym. You don't need to listen to it, but you need to show up as a leader and say, hey, look, no matter what happens, my self-worth is safe with me, so that you can have a foundation to go on and do great things in your life. So put that into practice. It's going to take some time. It's going to take some effort because, like I said, you have this core belief, and that's not going to go away overnight. But by repeatedly sort of practicing both restructuring your thoughts and also diffusing from them, I think you'll change slowly over time and with experience the way that you feel about yourself. And when you do, then your life will change as well.
Right. I'll give it a go. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Hi, doctor. I have a question.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. I'm in my early 20s, 21 more specifically. So kind of maybe more of an advice to your younger self. Yeah. Maybe I'm over rationalizing stuff a little bit, but how do you feel, or actually how do you deal with this kind of resentment that, you know, like how much time like dating life takes from you? And if you're like, you have your mind on like the higher target and you're thinking like all this time that goes to it, like you could have allocated to other stuff, like you could have allocated to your ambitions. Like how do you manage to be on that balance point? I don't know, like it's hard for me to get that middle ground.
Okay, so let me just make sure I'm understanding what you're saying. You're feeling a sense of resentment because of the amount of time that sort of dating is taking from you, and you could be spending that time, you know, doing other things. So let me just play devil's advocate. Then why are you spending so much time dating if you feel like it's not useful?
No, it's not that. It's not a matter of usefulness. I feel like those two things don't have too much like common ground, too much overlap. So it's like a zero-sum game between those two. So it's either or. You have to either allocate time to one thing or the other. But of course, both of them are like appealing, both paths. But it's just like, let's put it this way. A lot of my friends that I have who are also like successful with dating life and everything, it's like in my personal observation, most of their time revolves around that. Like it's just like immense amount of time that is going to that. And I'm thinking like, I don't know, like this is just too much time on that thing.
So why don't you just spend less time on it?
Well, probably like with less time, the success, the return is not as much.
Okay. So yeah, that makes sense. So you're saying, I understand now. You're saying if I spent less time dating and obviously reduce the opportunity cost, I might have less success. That may be true, but here's the thing. Dating is not a maximization exercise. You know what I mean? Where more is always better. I mean, it depends on kind of what your goals are, but I would say for most people, if the end game, so to speak, is a monogamous relationship with one person, maximizing the amount of time that you're spending or overdoing is not helpful. I would say, you know, when you're talking about your friends who are spending a lot of time dating, they're more successful. probably true, like to some degree, in the sense that, look, anything you want to get good at, you have to spend time and investment in. But I actually think dating is not one of those things where it, you need to like go on, let's say, 3 to 5 dates a week in order to try to find the one. The reason is it's very random, right? So let's contrast this to a skill, right? Like the previous caller was talking about weightlifting. With weightlifting, there's a very direct linear correlation to the amount of time and effort that you put in. Like if I look at the number of sets that you're doing per week, it will basically predict how strong you're getting and how much muscles you'll grow, right? Someone who does 5 versus 10 versus 15 sets a week, the person who's doing 15 sets a week, they're gonna grow more. Let's compare that to dating. If you go on 5 versus 10 versus 15 dates a week, you're not going to necessarily get better outcomes. Maybe slightly, just in terms of you're meeting more people and maybe you'll just hit the lottery with one of them. But, you know, there's a lot of times where people would just go on, you know, one date and that's it. I actually, you know, worked with someone. They went on OkCupid. Literally the first person they met ended up becoming their girlfriend for years. And now they're married and they have a kid. Now, maybe they got really lucky, but it just goes to show that dating is way more random, essentially, than basically most other activities in which you invest in. And so I don't think you actually need to maximize the amount of time in order to get good returns. You just have to find a reasonable sort of balance in terms of, look, you have to meet a decent number of people. You probably need to try different channels. But here's the thing that I would say. If you are feeling that you're not getting the results that you want, you're feeling resentment that it's taking time away from other things that are important to you, then listen to your intuition, right? There's something that's telling you that this is a little too, that there's something off about this and that you're sacrificing in a sense for that. And I think the only downside is that you're afraid that if you somehow turn down the spigot of the faucet, that your dating life is going to get worse. I don't necessarily think that's true. I think that what I would suggest is you may want to actually figure out how to work smarter, not work harder. And how can you reduce the amount of time that you're investing in dating, but still get, you know, a decent amount of results and still be hanging around the hoop playing the game so that you're going to get lucky and find that person. Does that make sense?
No, yeah, that totally makes sense. And that's what was one of the things I was going to ask, like, how do you play it smarter?
So, well, let me ask you a question. Are you single right now? Are you trying to find someone? Okay, that's a very different scenario than obviously in the context of in a relationship. Because I was going to say, with a relationship, you do have to put a decent amount of time. But even then, it's like you can negotiate with that person and just be like, hey, you know, I have a lot of clients who are busy running companies. They're in relationships and they negotiate all the time with their partners about what's a decent amount of time that's not going to take away from their primary mission in life. And that's a tough negotiation, but understanding partners understand that, right? So I think in your case, though, you're like, okay, how can I spend a decent amount of time that helps me find someone, but it's not taking away? So here's tip number one. You may want to try to kill two birds with one stone. A lot of times people find that when they're, especially they're single guys and they're going and doing things for the explicit intention of meeting people, if they don't, like, let's say you go out to a venue, you go out to a bar, you go out to a club, you go around to a mall just with the explicit intention of talking to and meeting women. There's nothing wrong with that. And you should do it to some extent in order to put yourself out there. But it seems like a very low ROI activity if you're not getting the results that you want, right? And that's understandable because you're like, I wouldn't do this if I was in a relationship, right? Versus the other way to approach it is I'm going to go do the things that I like to do. And if I happen to meet someone along the way, then great. So I'll give you an example of this. I have friends who actually like to dance as guys. Like they like doing the salsa. They like doing those things. Or they like playing beach volleyball, let's say. It doesn't matter what the activity is. But they're like, I'm going to go do what I like to do. And it's hopefully a social thing and it's a co-ed thing because obviously that's going to increase your odds of meeting someone. And if you happen to meet someone along the way, great. But if you don't, it's not like, oh, I wasted 2 hours at a club trying to talk to a girl. You're like, I still got to play volleyball. I still got to get in shape. I still got to dance. I got better at something. So you don't consider it a complete waste of time. So that's one example. Do activities that you like to do and you may serendipitously meet people along the way. Second thing is, think about less about going out and dating in particular venues. I actually think bars and clubs are terrible ways to meet people, especially if you're looking for a long-term relationship. But if you're like, look, I'm going to go about my day. I need to go shopping at Trader Joe's anyway. I need to go run some errands. I need to go mail things. And as I'm doing so, I'm aware of my surroundings. I'm noticing people. I'm striking up conversations. I'm not like hitting on every single person that I see, but I'm just being friendly. I'm being open. And I may serendipitously find someone. And that way you're like, oh, I didn't go kill 2 hours trying to go find someone. You're like, I was going and doing my normal life anyway. And maybe I saw someone cute at Trader Joe's. Maybe I didn't. But you've essentially had zero loss of time in the context of doing so. That's the second example. Third example is you can even do that, by the way, for dates. Not every single date needs to be taking a woman out for dinner and doing fancy things. Sure, you should do that some of the time, but there's lots of things in which you can do. Be like, hey, you know what? I need to go, I don't know, let's go drop this thing off, or let's go do this thing. Let's go shopping together, right? You can totally do things, activities of daily life, even in the context of a first or second date, and still do what you need to do. So that's the thing I would encourage you to do, is to think about dating, or at least finding someone, as less of a separate activity that you need to do that's removed from the rest of your life and takes away from the prioritization of the other things, and try to integrate it more into your life. Go live your life, do the things that you want to do. And in the course of doing so, hopefully you'll meet people. And that's not to say never do anything with the explicit intention of dating, but I don't think you need to do 100%. I would encourage you to think about trying to just meet people in the normal, ordinary course of your life. And that way, if you do it, or in the pursuit of hobbies that you're naturally going to do anyway and you enjoy, or you go on dates and you're like, look, this date was not for me, but I got to play pool and I enjoyed it anyway, regardless of this person was fun for me, you're gonna feel less resentment, because you're choosing to do things that you would have done anyway and you would have enjoyed.
Yeah, that totally makes sense.
All right. Well, great. Thanks, great question. Good luck with that. I know it's hard to be single in 2021. Like I said, if you put yourself first, you put your personal development first, you need to put some time aside. And like I said, I think it's really about opening your sort of spatial awareness around these things. And you will find many, many opportunities to meet people if you just think about like life as an opportunity to just meet good people and have good conversations, then as opposed to like, oh, I need to go out and date, right? Like I'm spending 5 hours a week dating. Get out of that framework and just be like, look, I'm going to live my life. And naturally, in the course of doing so, I will meet people, I will talk to people, and hopefully meet someone that I'm interested in, and go do interesting things with them too. So this is kind of like what they talk about. Instead of work-life balance, is work-life integration. What I'm encouraging you to do is work a life dating integration, as opposed to the rest of your life and dating as two separate opposing things that are at war with one another. Weave them together, and I think you'll have better results. If there's anything that you've learned from listening to these conversations, is like, look, all of us, myself included, we're all trying to learn. We're all trying to grow. We all kind of mess up, right? And if you can empathize with yourself, then that you're in your own journey of growth, that holds true for every single other human being out there, right? So just as you're messing up, you know that other people are messing up too. And we should have humility, and we should have empathy, and understand that other people are going through the same shit we are. And we're all connected as one people, and we should bond together instead of pushing each other apart. So that's my message for this week. That's my message forever, quite frankly. But thank you for being on this journey with us at Maximus. It warms my heart to get these great messages and DMs from you, to get these great questions from you. And it's my very humble and joy to help support you in your personal development as men, as human beings, and as productive members of society. So thanks for joining us. I'll talk to you again next Thursday.